Parking lot, just to say, hey.
Of the council committee meeting of April 1st to order. First committee, committee of the whole, board and commission interviews. First person is design and preservation committee, and that's Julie Kenworthy. Julie, if you'd come up, give me your name and address, please, for the record. Name and address.
Julie Kenworthy, 919 Fieldstone Drive.
Hey, tell us a little bit about why you want this position.
Well, as I put on my application, I care about preservation professionally and personally. Very important. I'm director of the Kent Historical Society. I care about the Kent community. I think it's important that design and preservation has the guidelines and the ordinances, so decisions can be made objectively instead of subjectively, and I think that's important. You know, I just think it's a good fit for me, and that's pretty much it.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Julie? No? Heidi? No?
I just had the comment. Thank you for putting yourself forward for this position, and you know, your background matches the requirements of the position really well. So thanks.
I worked with Julie for probably 15 years, and you couldn't find a better person or better fit for this position. So thank you, Julie. You're done.
Am I done?
Yeah, you are. Next, our city staff updates.
They're all sitting there like, who goes first? I'll go first. So I left at your table. I wanted to give you the latest version, the most current version, and it's a slightly new format because this is our sort of the summary of kind of what are the top strategic threats, opportunities, programs, and efforts that we're doing in this 2026/27 year. All of that is deeply in here for those that have the fortitude to wade through it. For those that do not, that's what the summary's for. And we did try to change the, be honest, I'm tired of that old chart that I gave you every other year, and it's in there. It's good. It's a little more detailed. It's that chart. It kind of replaces this thing. It's good. It's got a little more detail. You still got it, and it hasn't changed much. So if you want a little extra, go in there. But otherwise, we wanted a little fresher, more visual, graphic representation of this kind of like, what are our high nails that we're working on, focusing on? I'll repeat it. We always work on everything to some extent, but these are the focus areas. And this tries to capture why the focus areas. Part of the reason also I'm doing this in a couple of weeks, I have my annual chamber. They sort of call it State of the City. I think that's, I don't like that wording. It's update from the city manager. And I think I'm going to take that this time, because last time I typically find, I've been doing these for 20 years, and they used to be monthly, but they're not anymore. People generally are most interested in what new business, who's closing, who's coming in here, when's my street going to get paved, what's the, you know, the latest issue in the news. They generally aren't super enthusiastic about strategic planning stuff. But if you recall, during the charter review, Mr. Sheldahl made a comment that I went to Dave's luncheon and he didn't even talk about strategy. So I'm listening and I'm trying to be responsive, and I will have these at the tables that night. So anyways, that's my short piece for you. Conversations anytime on this stuff, as always. Our plate is pretty full right now. So I don't exactly know kind of how to roll out a larger potential strategy update sessions with you guys, although I am currently I'm on the executive board of the Porter's Development Board, and they're going through a strategic planning process, and they have a consultant that I find intriguing. So I want to see if he's good, and because facilitators make the world of difference. It's not great when the staff tries to do it. It's not great when the mayor tried, nothing against the mayor. It's not great when the mayor tries to do it. And it's not great if you get a bad third party consultant. You need a good one. So I'm on the hunt for that. Certainly if any of you guys know folks that do this as a profession, that don't have a bias because you're on the council, let us know, because we will certainly open to that conversation. Anyways, that's my update. Jim, you caught me right before the meeting. Do you want to do yours next?
Thank you. There we go. So in January, at one of the council meetings, we brought up Summit and Stowe Street, and Councilman Tipton made a recommendation that we look into quiet zones at the crossing, since we're going to be working in that area. And Mr. Bliss came in last month and spoke to you all about quiet zones. I just wanted to give you an update and let you know what we've been doing since January when Councilman Tipton brought it up. So we've been doing research into quiet zones in general, but also into specifically one that would be around the CSX crossing at Summit Street. When we were doing that research, we contacted other communities in our area that have quiet zones. We've spoken with them. We've got the pricing that they were quoted or told from the railroad what they would have to do. They've sent us their contractual agreements, and we've read and gone through those. We've also been sort of canvassing the community to try to find out how important this is to the community. So in that time period, there's several topics that we've been looking into. One is just what infrastructure is in there today. And you see that I passed out a map that shows there's 10 public crossings in Kent owned by three railroads. This does not include private crossings, at-grade crossings, which trains would blow their horns for, or crossings that are just outside the city of Kent, literally like just outside the city of Kent. And there's also information there on the number of trains per day. This was obtained from the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. In case you didn't know, they have some authority over railroads in Ohio, provide information. So this is directly off their website. We looked at safety impacts for quiet zones. I'm not in here to go into a lot of details. I'll just give you some of the high level things that came up. The safety issues actually get divided into two different categories. The first is the one that most people think of, which is, okay, the gates go down, and to offset the safety measures from a train horn, because that's what it's for, they do something that prevent cars from going around railroad bucks is what they call them. That's one. The other factor is we got a study from the USDOT and the Federal Railway Administration talking about the potential increase on rail crashes in quiet zones for trespassing crashes. This is basically when people are trespassing on right-of-way owned by the railroad, and then they would not have the benefit of the horn going off when they're in that area. And you're like, well, where could that be here? But for the many of you know, we have lots of homeless populations that move up and down those railroad tracks. If you're at Plum Creek Park, you can literally walk right on the rail line, right in that area. And if I was just there yesterday for lunch, and the train went by and it blew its horn because they're right by, their people could be getting on their tracks. So there's two different kinds of safety. We looked at planning and budgetary costs. We got costs from other communities, so we have a good idea of what it could be. The problem is it's all based on the railroad. If the railroad says we want this and it's going to cost the optimistic, less expensive version, great. If the railroad wants something more, it's going to cost something more. And there's really basically four countermeasures. The one that Mr. Bliss brings up, and you see in other areas that have few pedestrians, fairly inexpensive. Cuyahoga Falls had one of those put in, and then 3/4 mile down the tracks, they wanted another one, and the rail line said, no, you need to put in a quad gate, and it's going to cost you $750,000. So that the benefit just wasn't there, so they didn't move forward. So just to give you some idea, there's a range the costs can be, and it's really up to the railroad to decide what it's going to be. And you can't get their attention until you have a study done, and then you pay them to review the study. So we also looked at the long-term requirements. It's not like you build it and you're done. If you've seen the delineators and plows will go by and it'll hit them. If they're not fixed and repaired, the trains will just start blowing their horns again. You're required to deal with it. You have to re-up every 5 years. And there's the contract's fairly, well, it's not fair. It leans on the side of the railroad. So, and lastly, we looked at community interest. At the workshop, you notice we passed out on the tables, quiet zones were part of it, thinking that, you know, this is the kind of investment that would compete with splash pads and other things. So we wanted to get the community's feel for it. So at our next workshop, which is going to be after the next council meeting, you'll see how many people brought up comments along these lines. But it's better fit, in my opinion, to go along with that process since the investment. So that's what we've been working on. It's fluid. So we get, as we get more information, we get a better picture of its positives and negatives for the city of Canton.
Questions, Chris?
Thanks, Jim. Looking at the Summit intersection with Mogador, and I'm seeing that there are two companies. There's the CSX and there's ABC. Would we have to do studies with each of them at that intersection?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, if you wanted both to not blow their horns, yes.
Okay. They're grade separated, are they not?
No, those are both at grade crossings.
The lower?
No.
Oh.
These is very steep. You go over one, then you go down the hill and you hit the other. So.
Thanks.
Further questions for Jim? Thanks, Jim.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Melanie, you want to go? Because Bridget, I know, then you have an item. You might as well stay up there. So the walk away from Jim is, he was very kind to say, hey, I understand you briefed council. He's like, yeah, don't do that next time because it's a lot more complicated than what you told council the first time. He's like, I appreciate your help. But so part of what I said is make sure you explain that the solution, even the consideration of the options can be expensive and it's complicated. So we're working on it, but hang in there with us because it's going to take some iterations. Melanie?
Great, thank you. I just want to take a few quick moments just to remind everybody it's spring and we're ready to move into our spring cleaning. We got to move into our brush chipping just a little bit earlier than we had anticipated with a couple of these windstorms. We actually brought our chipper trucks out that Thursday after the windstorm, which was March 13th through the 16th. Typically, we do not bring that out until the beginning of May when we do our spring brush collection. We've been canvassing the town now for about 3 weeks. We'll continue to do it for one more week. Then we'll put it on rest because we have other activities we have to get back to, but then it will come back out. Just as a quick reminder, we do our brush chipping in the month of May. So you got that in your Tree City Bulletin. Everybody can take a look at it. It's by section and quadrants within the city. And we start the week of May 4th and continue through the end of the month. The yard waste site also was opened 3 weeks early because of the storm. So we've been maintaining that as well. And that's, again, open on Tuesdays during the day and Wednesday evenings tonight from 5 until 8. Now that we have the light, when we first started, I'm like, the first guy stayed till 8 o'clock. I'm like, nobody probably showed up after about 6:30. So we've been trying to accommodate with that. So that's that as well, too. We want to give a gentle reminder that, again, also in May is our large spring cleanup where everybody gets to do their spring cleaning and bring it all out to the yard and have that picked up by Republic. I do want to remind everybody that there are recycling options. We also have a scrap tire pickup, and that will be at the end of the month, and that is scheduled right now for, I think, Thursday, May 28th. That will be at the water reclamation plant, and that's from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. So we'll be taking those tires, no fee. As always, though, we do have an excellent Portage County solid waste facility over on Mogador Road that collects a lot of these things year-round. So I'd like to also promote that. You can take your scrap tires there, automotive oils, greases, those kinds of things, as well as your batteries, latex, paints, and they take those on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I believe, during certain hours. Again, that is also in the Tree City Bulletin. So please remind everybody that we have those things and those options available to us. I just wanted to bring that to everybody's attention in case you have any questions in light of the pending storms that we've been going through.
Any questions for Melanie? Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you.
Bridget?
Thank you. I have three brief updates before I go into my committee items. I wanted to let everyone know we released a request for qualifications to hire a consultant to do an update to the comprehensive housing study and needs analysis, which we call the housing study for short. Proposals are due back April 9th. We anticipate being under contract for that in May. It will take a few months, but they are going to take the housing study that we did in 2016, which we did to basically get quantitative data to support some of the anecdotal information that we were seeing come through our department. We had 2,500 beds of student housing go in a four-year period between 2012 and 2016. And there were concerns that potentially we were getting over-inventoried in one type of housing and not another. I will caveat that by saying private development does have not be completely controlled 100% of the time, but we did want to have data to hopefully persuade developers to look in other directions. That housing study has proved to be a very valuable tool. Much of the information in there has actually come to fruition and been supported, so we're looking forward to getting an update as we move forward for another 10 years. We are also going to be releasing a request for qualifications next week for the completion of an economic development strategy. As Dave has mentioned many times, economic development has actually been at the forefront of much of what we do, the downtown redevelopment and many of the other aspects. But the Charter Review Commission did highlight that they would like to see a separate study. So we are moving forward with that. Timeline the same. We anticipate being under contract for that by the end of May. So we will be coming back with those reports. By the way, each time we hire a consultant to do these types of analyses, we do make them come back, do a presentation of the final project or the final reports to council so they're aware of some of the highlights of that. So that will be coming to you later this summer. And finally, I did want to mention, Dave, I think, sent an email already that Main Street Kent has requested that the administration allow time at committee next month to discuss the time frames for the opening of the Franklin or the closing of the Franklin Street. I want to highlight for the press that is here, we are not removing it. It is nothing more than Main Street Kent did a survey of their DORA participants based on some information they had been receiving in the last few months. And we want to ask for time to present that information and let council consider. Primarily, it was a shift of time from opening it on Memorial Day with closure on Labor Day, which is kind of the informal start and end of summer, versus now where it's the first Saturday in May and runs through the last Saturday in October, which is about 5.5 months. Again, we will bring in that information and a representative from Main Street Kent will be here to discuss that with you.
Bridget, any questions for Bridget? Ben?
The housing study, RFQ, are we adding any elements like comparing the study that we received a number of years ago?
It's an update to it. So in other words, it's going to look at all of the trends and the actual of what has occurred and then compare it to, we're going to need new census data. We'll be looking at, obviously, the enrollment trends. That study did predict, by the way, through looking at the feeder high schools into Kent State, that there would be an enrollment decline beginning starting the last year. That has proved to be an accurate point, as was highlighted by Dana, if you remember just last month. So we will be looking at all that again. What are those feeder high schools? Is the enrollment trend that for another 10 years? This study did look at a 10-year period, so this will be looking at it again. So we'll be looking at all of it, but we'll also be looking at, for example, we do have that housing now, and if there is a declining student enrollment, how will that reflect and hit that private sector, the multi-units in that private sector? So that'll all be examined.
I read that study a number of years ago, and I can't remember if it addressed the expressed need of, like, the demand for, like, family housing or different family types.
It wasn't necessarily a demand. It was just saying that we didn't have as much of the basically working family rental, as well as what they called empty nester, which is not a phrase that's used anymore, of housing. We would call it age-restricted housing now. So it'll look at all of that. One thing I do want to highlight is the housing study does an inventory of our housing, of what is available. But at the end of the day, in private development, we can guide and incentivize development through our zoning and certain aspects of programming, but it is a private endeavor, so it cannot be completely controlled. I handed that housing study to every developer that walked through community development, which is at least, I don't know, that dealt with housing at least a half a dozen a year since that study's been out, told them we're really over inventoried on student oriented housing. What we would love to see is some empty nester housing, some opportunities for condominiums, townhomes. And 8 out of 10 of them said, that's great. And then they presented with something for student oriented housing. It's all about the return on investment. And there's a high value return on investment in student oriented housing, more so than there is in owner occupied or in empty nester housing.
I just follow up on that before we jump. I'm sorry, Heidi. I do want to say, though, Benjamin, if you didn't hear what she was talking about, it does a Kent market housing market assessment.
Yes.
It identifies where there's gaps, where there's overbill, oversupply, undersupply, and it can look at special things. I would encourage you, because last time, I think it was part in advance. If we know in advance specific things, like you just made the comment, you know, maybe I don't want to overinterpret it, but conventional family housing, or is it starter home housing? Is it middle home housing? Is it retiree housing? There's a lot of segments in the market. So there's no shame in letting us know, like, I'm particularly interested if there's a way the consultant can make sure they kind of, in their market assessment, take a particular look at this segment or that segment. They will look at it.
They'll look at
it. But we're happy to emphasize areas. And this is still early enough that if you got stuff, email,
I can send you the RFQ.
Tell us.
I can send the RFQ out to council, and you can see it's comprehensive in its scope. It looks at all housing, and it will be actually not only looking at Kent, because we have extensive residential development right outside of Kent, which wasn't there. So that will need to be evaluated in terms of, like, how many of them will be into Kent City Schools, how many of them actually looked coming to Kent, because Brimfield Township is actually many of those fringe neighborhoods just south of 261 are actually coming into Kent. So that is inventory that we will have to look at. It's not just going to be specific to our jurisdictional boundary. We're going to look at proximity as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was something I was going to say too, was the housing that's being built on the right around Kent, and how that would also impact. But I wanted to ask, is that moratorium on rent per bed housing still in place?
We never had a moratorium on a rent per bed.
On the cut type of student housing?
We did not have a moratorium on that. We tried to put in a temporary moratorium to stop the student-oriented housing that was going in on the Presbyterian Property Council, denied that temporary moratorium, and that project was built.
Oh, I thought we had a, we were.
I did change the zoning to make it conditional. That's what
we did. It's conditional?
Yeah. When the temporary moratorium to basically slow that project down and give us the opportunity to really evaluate how it would affect that market over there, council allowed it to go through. It was a permitted use, so the Planning Commission could not deny that. But after that, we did change multi-unit student-oriented housing in the university zoning district to conditionally permitted.
One of the things we're hoping to study, but it articulates a little clearer this comment that we often make, because people get all excited about, let's get some of these big economic development projects, or let's get a big housing tract. If someone can generate new land in Kent, that would be great. Now, our greatest obstacle is the amount of buildable land or lack thereof. I mean, Bridget's made comments before, like, there's one big parcel left, you know. Now, so what we're dealing with is a lot of infill, repurposing. There's a couple spots too that, you know, that we could work with a developer to, but they're really far and few between. Many of them have legacy issues, like we saw down with the project with Copa Machinery. You're not really going to put housing on that ever because of the contaminated soils. And there's some of those kind of things, being an older city that had those corridors. So my point is not to debate that here, but just to let you know, I'm hopeful that in the process of this study that they can articulate that or calibrate that in terms of, like, here's how much more capacity you have for housing of this size or that size.
Yeah, just a real quick on that. We are pretty much built out. That's what we tell, and all developers know that, which is why we did have a residential property come in for an industrial zoned area. Another caveat to that is we do have some availability south of 261. We have actually have it zoned for the type of housing that people would like to see. I think we call it the EQK property, because that was the name of the original developer that came to it. I've had that red folder in my office since 2009. I have discussed that property with no less than 20 developers, and it's not built because getting utilities to that site and the topography of that site make it challenging. So that's another variable. It's not just open green space. It costs to get utilities. We have a project right now on it's basically 261 in Campus Center Drive. It's going to be known as Oak Haven. It is going to be owner-occupied condos. They are running into challenges because of the utilities. That is at the end of a line, and there are some costs and challenges that were not anticipated when they did their original pro forma. So there is real costs to the utilities to service larger complexes.
One additional comment, and I can follow up with an email as well with more clarity on this idea, but I've lived in very urban settings and also mixed use settings in various different cities, and the use of accessory dwelling units is an innovative use where the utilities are already there. We do have neighborhoods that do have a bit of property. Sometimes they actually have back alleys or laneways behind the houses that can easily be utilized, and it would take zoning alterations to our existing zoning, but it could infill a little bit of the land that we currently have, because, you know, as evidenced across our community, we don't have open land to build new housing necessarily, but we do have sizable lots in some neighborhoods and even some lots that could have second accessory dwelling units. There are communities in northeastern Ohio that are using this because they want to increase density. They don't have the open space, and so they're applying ADUs to select zoning areas. And so that would be the only question that I'd like to add to the housing study of, like, how might that be applied to.
We have an overlay district, and that can be done. And we actually did one over at the province.
Okay.
So we do actually allow that in the zoning code. Our chapter 1104 allows for the we call them a preservation alternate or for an overlay district. So we actually do have that capability. The only caveat I would say to that is that we are a college town, and a significant number of our property is rental. So you have to be very careful how you apply that in a community where you have more rental properties than you do owner occupied.
Yes.
So it would have to be thoughtfully done. Province actually has some lower density and higher density when that overlay through. It was done in 2010. Heidi, I think you were on council at the time. Jack, you were. Mm-hmm. So it was a mix. We allowed higher density in an R3 to allow that to go in. But there was friction points with people that were in single family in the Marigold neighborhood and such that did not want this. So it there there's a push and pull, especially if you're a college town. I think it would be less so if we weren't a college town, but that is a which actually kind of leads me into my first item on committee with the rental creep into residential areas. So it can be done now under the zoning code. We have not had anyone come to us to do that since the province, however.
But the overlay district is, what are the parameters?
You're thinking the overlay district as applies to downtown.
Yeah.
Overlay, that is basically the West River overlay district, but there can be, there was a, the province had its own overlay district. An overlay is basically a district that provides zoning for a specific type of development that overlays an existing zoning. So that can be put over any zoning district in the entire city. Okay. Though just the one downtown here is over the CD and several other zoning districts, but the province was put over an R3. Allowed for higher density and multifamily because neither of those were allowed in an R3.
Okay.
So if somebody, a developer came to us to talk to us about that, or somebody wanted to do that, we would work with them on what they wanted and how that overlay would come, and then it would have to go to planning commission and then to council.
Other questions? Bridget?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any more staff? Nope.
She's got the next item though.
Yeah,
so okay, so we'll turn it over to Ms. Schaefer-Bish.
All righty. Let's open up with the proposed new down payment assistance program. Segue.
Yes, exactly. That's what I said. So this is a pilot program, and we've had discussions with council informally over the last couple of years about this program. So the city does run an owner-occupied housing rehabilitation program that is funded through with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Fund. So this would be funded through general fund money, because the limitations when you use the state of Ohio or HUD money is that it is limited to 80% or below the area median income, which is, we want this, basically our goal with this program and using general fund is to transition single family properties in residential areas that are currently being used as single family rentals, which is rented to a family or no more than two unrelated, back to owner occupied. With the drop in enrollment and the issues that we've had in the courts, it seemed like this might be a good time to do that. So it'll be a pilot program. We're looking for $50,000. And the way it would be structured is they would be a $10,000 forgivable loan deferred, no payment due, with $1,250 forgiven each year for an 8-year period. At that point, your obligation would be met. If the property is sold prior to that, that $1,250 would actually be proportionately repaid. Based on, like, if you're there for 5 years, as my example in the memo shows, you would then owe for 3 years of that $1,250, so $750,000. However, if you sell the house before that 8-year period to another rental, 100% of the $10,000 will be due back. This is very similar and not, it's not onerous, because this is exactly how our mortgages are structured in our rental rehab program. I mean, in our housing rehab program, you cannot make it a rental. We've had two loans that I've had to actually call that would have been deferred and paid in full at the time the deed transferred to a new owner, but the owners actually turned them into rentals. It was caught and it was, it had to go back. That was a HUD requirement. So we are not putting a burden in here. And the 8 years seemed like a reasonable amount of time. I know that I've looked at several other programs in other cities that are running stuff. And it seems that anything past 10 is a little too long. It makes people nervous. How many of us are going to know where we're going to be in 10 years, right? Where with 8 years, it seemed like a reasonable time. And with that smaller amount deferred each year or forgiven each year, it would be less burdensome if they did have to leave because of a transfer or some other reason they would have to leave the Kent community. We would ask for documentation. They have a mortgage and the HUD one, so we have information on exactly when closing is, and we would require that our mortgage be filed in second position, which means that way then if there were to be a default, we would be paid after the primary mortgage. Sometimes when you get a primary mortgage, you can also be provided a line of credit. So that could be second. We would not allow that. We would be second position and third, because when you're in third position, you are not getting paid back. That I can tell you. So we're real excited about this program. I've actually informally talked to a couple real estate agents about it and some of the banks, and they're very excited too. This basically would give a little breathing room so that if somebody was they'd buy a rental that has to be registered and licensed in the community development single family rental licensing program for a minimum of a year, which matches the HUD program, which required you to be living in the property a minimum of a year before you could be eligible for the assistance. They would basically then be able to use that $10,000 offset what they use for down payment, closing costs, or maybe needed repairs.
Any questions?
Jeff? Less of a question, more of a comment. I've been basically churning this idea in my head for the last 20 years or something similar to it. So just thank you for getting it done.
Anybody else?
I do. I have a couple questions. I thank you for doing the research on like 10 years, 8 years, whatever other year configurations. But I'm wondering if deed restrictions were ever explored.
We actually discussed deed restrictions, and we've actually had programs over the years. I've been doing this for a long time, since 97, and there were programs that required deed restrictions. Deed restrictions are actually not caught as often as they should be, because it's based on the title company. But if there's a private transaction, which actually happens a lot in our rental inventory, basically a landlord will sell and you'll never see it go basically through a real estate agent or anything like that. So a title search is going to find that deed restriction typically, where if it's a recorded mortgage, they literally cannot go anywhere without having that notification to the mortgage holder. So that's a more secured way to do it. The deed restrictions, we've used them in other programs and twice they have not been caught. So I prefer filing the mortgage. It's also cleaner for the property owner, when you basically have entanglements associated with a deed. I'm sure Hope can speak to this. It complicates it. And oftentimes the bank, the primary mortgage holder will say, we're not touching this. So it won't be an issue for the first acquisition, but then when they go to try to sell it, if there's a deed restriction in there, it could complicate their ability to sell that house. So the recorded mortgage is a cleaner way and it's guaranteed to be seen. We get mortgages that were filed back when my predecessor Gary was just starting out. I'm talking from the 80s. And those mortgages, once that deed goes to transfer, they're caught because they're all recorded. So the deed restriction is a little more complicated.
Another question. The 1 year rental, how is that time scale chosen? Because I think the most problematic properties that we'd want to transfer or incentivize the transition of the housing are probably the ones that have been rentals for a longer time scale than one. I'm just aware of a number of houses that have sold that have been bought by outside big conglomerates in our community, and they've rented them for a very short period of time. And those aren't yet a problem necessarily, but it's those that have been rentals for a longer period of time. You know, it's just the degradation of the property that is the biggest blight that and most commented complaint of rentals. And so how was the 1 year chosen?
I would be comfortable making it longer but not shorter, because it'll flip.
Agreed.
It'll flip. Longer. It'll flip. I mean, these rentals turn over like you wouldn't even believe. I mean, like I said, we live, they literally don't even hit the market. So my concern is somebody will buy one, have their kid live in it or themselves live in it, and then 3 months later say, oh, it was a rental, I'm eligible for this $10,000. So we could make it a longer period that it has to be. We have been running our, you know, council authorized the community development to do the single family rental program in 2016. It began in 2019. So we have a long enough history that we could make it a 2 year, we could make it, it has to be in the program 3 year. I am comfortable with that change. I just didn't want it to be less than a year, and the year matches what we require for the HUD rehab program. So I have no problems with adjusting that.
And so since this is a pilot and we're trying to learn, I would be supportive of increasing that just to see what the market demand is, because we're basically talking about five, right? We're piloting with five transfers.
Correct.
And so let's see what the market.
What year would you think?
I don't know.
Definitely other
three.
Ideas.
Definitely. We can do that. Three. Okay.
Are we comfortable with three?
Three.
Yeah, so 3 years in the community development rental licensing program. Okay.
I mean, if we,
I have no objections
if
at all.
There's no demand.
Yes.
Then
we'll roll it back. Yeah. Right.
But 1 year is definitely, I would say, not enough. It's like enough to get someone in there and then like collect that $10,000.
They still have to stay eight or pay it back.
Still would have to.
Yeah.
But I feel like 1 year.
It's 1 year in our rental licensing program.
Yes. I feel like 3 years would say I'm committed to this program.
Well, the 3 year is for being in the rental licensing program for the house to be eligible. They still have to stay in this house 8 years. It's 3 years in. Basically, we have to have documentation in the community development department that that property has been a licensed registered rental for 3 years. Right. So the 3 years is on the house, not on the borrower.
Okay.
The 8 years would be for the borrower.
Thank you for being flexible.
Oh, yeah, I have no problem. Trust me, we went back and forth. There was no perfect time, but we felt like, well, we could use a year because that's what HUD used. But I'm fine with longer. No problem. So 3 years is fine. Is there any other aspects of it anyone needed to adjust?
I just had a question about how it would be advertised for the pilot program.
So we will develop the documents and the application and all of the mortgage, make sure, have the law department look at everything. And then we would most likely go through, first reach out to real estate agents and banks. It would be helpful with the financial institutions to find one that might want to partner with us. So they might be the first people we speak to see if they're willing to provide some kind of incentive along with it. Like, oh, yeah, we would love that. And we're willing to maybe give a discount on points or a discount on closing costs. Will that happen? I'm not sure, but it would be nice to ask at least. And I have no problem asking. I know enough of the bankers in those local banks to ask that.
The one bank we met with said that very thing. They said, as soon as you get that, we will bundle a package with some of our own discounts, and it'll be, in their words, the best rates you can get. And that's what we want. So I think we would try to use the real estate agents that she's talked to, obviously the traditional things that we advertise, but also really kind of make sure that the financial institutions and the real estate agents know about
it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Yes, Melissa.
I was just going to say, this is a very great creative way to try to solve several different issues that we have in the city, and also help maybe a first time home buyer get into a home in our community. So
yes,
beautiful all the way around. I think 3 years is a really good number to start with, because for all the reasons that Ben was talking about, you know, the community where I live, there are a lot of houses that have been in the rental, and I love our renters too, but some of those homes are starting to deteriorate, and it would be great to see them turned over to a home buyer who really wants to. So thank you for always being creative and looking for these opportunities. And I hope you find the bank that's really going to help provide some additional incentives too.
And the timing is just perfect too, because anecdotally, as the last housing study, I was based on anecdotal from developers. I'm getting a lot of anecdotal from landlords. Single family rentals are sitting idle. Statement I heard, I have all my units leased up by spring break. I'm still sitting with five, and I'm hearing this from others. So it's good that we're looking at the housing study. It's good that we're looking at this program, because it'll allow houses that, for lack of a better word, are no longer profit generating for a landlord to be able to be sold and bought by someone that wants to live in one of these neighborhoods close to the town and close to campus.
I also just want to say that if this program takes off, don't wait a year to come back and ask for us to be able to help five more Hallmark.
Oh, I love that. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
I'll be back.
You don't have a question? Ben?
I had one more comment, and it just flitted to mind when I first read the packet, and that was the source of funds. So we're talking about general fund, and we did just get the state allocation for the marijuana tax, and I felt like this might actually be a good use of those funds, and then it's not direct taxpayer community tax dollars being spent on this pilot. It could be the windfall that is the marijuana funds. I know that we are putting those in escrow now for future use, but that was just a thought that I had.
I mean, generally speaking, and Rhonda could speak specifically speaking, generally speaking, those receipts will get put in to the general fund and mixed with all the rest of our stuff. So it's not, you know, it's not like it gets its own, it's all put in the same general pot. Now, if we want to change that, she can set up a special that track it, but we never know in a given year, like where we're going to need it, how are we going to need things? So we, there's always that balance of keep it general or get specific with it. So, but to your point, you're not wrong in making the statement. You could spend up to, what was it, 180, whatever it was, the amount that we got, and you could make legitimate statement that that's, if that's what we spend, that was essentially funded through that source.
Chris, did you have something?
Yeah. I was curious about the, so it's 10,000 program participant, no matter income level they're coming in on.
Right. We don't want.
Did you think about that?
Yes. So as I've been doing housing since 1997, mm-hmm. and we've had housing is typically always capped at 80%. However, during the housing crisis between 2010 and 2012, we were allowed to go up to 100, and then we had another program that allowed us to go up to 120. And while it was a lot easier to find assistance to those who could get the primary loan in those programs when they were at 100 and 120. If somebody comes to us and they can make this work, we don't want to base it on their household income. If council decides they do want to do that, we can. And we do that. We've done that with other programs, and we definitely are required to do that with our state and federal programs. But I just feel like the opportunity to not tie it to income, which the other communities that I was looking at that were college towns did not, it's incentivizing converting a rental into home ownership. We just want you to have that commitment and not income, but we can look at it. I mean, it may be that after we do these first five, we see that they all fall within a certain income level. We can be like, oh, well, it seems to be hitting those that are at 90% of the area median income or 100% of the area median income. So
we had the information from the participants.
Because we are required to fill out, they're going to have to fill out an application, so we can collect the information, but it just won't be a qualifier whether or not you apply for funding or not. What will be the qualifier is, can you get that first position mortgage?
Yeah, I'm comfortable proceeding, but I'd love to hear after the first five.
And all that data is going to help us make it better. So right now, it's kind of like, you know, allowing us to do it this way, which reflects those two programs we did back, you know, whatever, 15, 20 years ago, will allow us to have that balance. Because if we can, you know, mark that down, and it will, they have to make this their primary. They can't buy this and be a snowbird. They have to, the criteria that they'll have to sign is that you will be living in this home as your primary residence. I mean, you go to Florida for a month, that's fine. But I don't want them, you know, leaving it vacant or thinking they can, you know, just do a sneaky rental. So we're going to be very specific.
Thank you.
Think of all the things that people have already tried to pull and make sure they're documented.
Yes. Agreed with that. Are there any additional questions from council? All right, let's go to the audience. Are there any questions or comments from the audience members? If so, come up to the microphone. Not seeing any. I'm going to take it back to council.
Can I ask one clarification? I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Benjamin asked some questions that were interesting, and it sparked something in my memory, Bridget, and you can tell me if I'm off. But he was getting to that issue of the deed, meaning is it kind of like stay permanent with the property? And your answer made sense. But I'm also, is there not certain of these rental units that once they go single family, they can't go back after a certain amount of time?
Well, they have to maintain in this program single family for 8 years. But they have to stay single.
I meant by like the zoning, like, and there's some that are grandfathered
you do not have single family rentals already in certain zoning districts. You can rent to a family in any zoning district. R1, R2, you could be in Riverbend and rent your house to a family. So you can rent in any neighborhood.
And I could be wrong, and I don't mean to spend.
So if you want a deed restriction to a certain geographic footprint.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to throw that in there. I was thinking that there were situations in our history with this favorite topic of ours, mm-hmm. where you made the case, hey, look, I know you want to do a rental property here, but we have proof that it's single family before you, so you can't go back to it. And they'll say, well, it was a rental 10 years ago. Okay. And then they say, no, It was 10 years. You say no, but it's been single family.
You're talking about pre-existing non-conforming uses. So that would be mm-hmm. for any house that was over two unrelated. So what we call a rooming house. A rooming house is a single family that allows 3 to 15 unrelated. Okay. So mm-hmm. there are pre-existing non-conforming of those mm-hmm. on University, for example, or Sherman, what we call grandfathered in. It's because they had more than two unrelated in a zoning district that doesn't allow it prior to the approval of the zoning code in 1971.
So, example.
Thank you.
My house was four apartments. Those four apartments were taken down. It can't go back to four apartments.
Correct.
It's now a single family.
That's correct.
So there's still a benefit. It's still a step in the right direction. Right. Our program should help that move the needle.
And any of these properties that are pre-existing non-conforming, you can continue a pre-existing non-conforming use as long as there isn't a stop in that use for 2 years. At 2 years, it converts to the existing, basically zoning. So for example, if there's a pre-existing non-conforming that allows four unrelated, and then they convert it to a single family, they move in 5 years, it can never go back to that four unrelated.
That's my question.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's right. Unless the Planning Commission says so.
Well, the Planning Commission can't approve pre-existing non-conforming. The burden is on the owner to prove that that zoning existed prior, and they have to get a variance. They wouldn't get it. Actually, the court case that we have at the Supreme Court level is it based on the pre-existing non-conforming use not being proven.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, do I have a motion from council?
I'll move to approve with emergency.
I'll second.
All right. Any comments? This is the time for comments, people. I allowed comments before, but did you have a comment? It's okay. It's okay. I'm excited to hear the comments too. All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say same sign. All right. Passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Woohoo. All right. Let's see. I think you're still up there, Bridget, with the proposed amendment to the community reinvestment area agreement with Mazda.
Yes. So this is really more of a housekeeping issue to make things equitable. So Mazda, and for those of you that are aware, we have community reinvestment areas. We have three. CRA 2 is out on West Main. They sign an agreement that is approved by council. Excuse me, and get an abatement on or an exemption on certain real property valuation increases after they've invested. So typically those projects would pay a $500 fee. We do an analysis. The reports are due March 31st. And this year they did go in March 31st. I was that busy. Usually I try to get them a little sooner, but I was like hitting that button right on time. But they are required to pay a $500 fee for the processing of that application and all the work that we do. Well, in 2023, the Ohio Department of Development eliminated that fee because it had been removed by the General Assembly from the Ohio Revised Code. All the other CRA agreements we have that had to pay that were approved after that time frame. Mazda, however, was approved in 2020, but they didn't actually begin to get their first exemption until 2023, 3 months before the state changed that fee was waived. So they've paid it for 2 years. But I just struggled this year that we had one business that was paying the $500 when the other businesses weren't going to be required to pay that $500 each year. So I contacted the Ohio Department of Development, my contact there in the incentives program, told him, and he's like, I agree. He goes, it's just a simple change that you're going to amend that to remove that would allow that to happen. So that's why I'm here before you, is to ask that we amend the CRA agreement with Mazda to remove the $500 annual fee. So they do not have to pay it for the rest of the time they're in the program, the agreements in place, to align with the three other agreements we have that have been approved.
Are there any questions from council? Any questions or comments from the audience? Back to council.
I'll move to approve with emergency.
All right. Any comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I just wanted to have to get rid of these blocking.
Okay. Finance. Ms. Chocko.
He's the safety grant. Sorry.
Chief Samuel is
for the authorization of a grant submission for fire safety equipment.
Good evening, everybody. I'm just here to quickly ask for your approval to submit for a $25,000 grant for some safety equipment for the fire department. There's a foundation called the Joey DiBernardo Foundation. He was an FDNY firefighter that died in the line of duty. He had to jump out of, didn't try to jump, but he tried to rappel with a rope when he was bailing out of an emergency on a fifth floor apartment house and fell and was critically injured along with three other firefighters. And out of this came a foundation that wanted to equip firefighters with proper rappelling equipment. You might think, why would a firefighter rappel out of a building? Well, it would be a last ditch effort, so you didn't have to jump. He was in an alleyway. And so this foundation, after he passed away, wanted to equip firefighters across the country. We actually do have some of this equipment, but it's kind of old first generation stuff from the beginning of my career. So all of our firefighters do not have it. So this would allow us to buy the gear for all our firefighters. They would carry it kind of in their side pocket of their bunker gear. It would be a hook, some webbing and rope as a, and a descender, like a friction device. We would hook it on something and simply scale down the side of a building that would hopefully prevent a catastrophic injury. So the grant request is for $25,000. That would buy personal equipment for all the firefighters. And there's required kind of a train the trainer program. And that costs $3,000. So that's built into that. There's no match to the city. We've prepared the grant as long as I could get your approval tonight. And with that, I would, if we are awarded, I would like budget and finance to appropriate that to the proper accounts.
Any comments from or questions from council? Anything from the audience? Back to council for a motion.
Move to authorize.
Second.
With emergency?
With emergency.
Mm-hmm. All in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome.
And then we have discussions of city staffing and funding options with Rhonda. Actually, Rhonda has two different things.
Right. She made me swear that we can tag team it. So it's
okay,
not just
all right.
So I have extra copies of the report. Does anybody want to have that in front of them? Like, it's up to you. Let me know. If not, like you want a copy? Thanks. There you go. And I got plenty. You want one? I'll send that down the stairs. So this, well, I think you know the topic. It's been up for conversation for a good year now. And, you know, we're inching our way towards the hardest question. I don't think anybody argues with the, I want to see streets paved, or I want to make sure our firefighters are adequately staffed because it matters in our community, police adequately staffed. That's never really been the debate. The debate is, great, how do we pay for it? And I know, go ahead, you can say it like usual. There's a lot of information in here. Once Dave gets started, Dave digs deep. Because I know so many of you are new that you don't have the benefit of the history with, like, are we rich? Are we poor? Are we what? You know, like, what are we working with? You don't really kind of have the context for it, right? So We spent some time and we tried to keep, there's a lot of data, but I try to make it readable, user-friendly, moderately self-explanatory, because I think if I put myself in your shoes and be like, well, what questions would I be asking? And so we've tried to have enough data in there to catch hopefully most of the questions that you would logically have. If you're like, hey, if I have to consider a new way to raise money, I want to know this. Have we done everything we want, you know, tried to do to avoid having to maybe go to the voters? Or do we have enough in the bank just to spend it? Do we get enough in income tax? Can we use property tax? And so we really kind of dug through those in the second half of this report. In the spirit of, like, okay, I still felt like I needed to tie it all together, right? Like, give you a cogent sort of walk you through the main points, and if I miss main points, we have plenty of time to talk about those. So timing, let me just say, we're not asking for a decision tonight. We really wanted an opportunity to begin to go through this kind of hard quantitative data with you. Rhonda can answer specific budget questions. The only timetable that's out there, and it's not, the good news story underlying all this, okay? There is a good news story. The good news story is the investments in the downtown, the strategy to use the downtown as a platform for economic growth worked. You can see that in the charts because we have Kent State's contributions going down, but yet we're going up. And, you know, we see big investments by Davey Tree, some of our big corporate folks, largely driven by kind of the revival of downtown and being part of that story and being the kind of place they want to do business in, raise families in, you know, all that stuff you guys are talking about all the time. And what we're, not only did that help us weather a storm, and for those that wouldn't know this, Dave Coffey, when Rhonda's predecessor, I mean, he had to live, the state cut $2 million a year away from us. So I know Kent State's dealing with their own cuts. But $2 million a year more we used to get. And it was like, that's a lot at a time when our total in, you know, revenues were probably $15 million. That was a pretty high percentage. It hurt. And it was, guess what? It was timed with the Great Recession. And so that's why you see in that one chart where the staffing has pretty much been pretty flat. And we talk about that we froze positions, we cut positions, and we tried to save $3 million over 2007 to 2010 through restrictions. And that's where council was arm wrestling with, well, we're going to bleed a slow death here if we don't do something. So they said, all right, let's take a run at the downtown to be a growth, you know, engine of growth, economic growth for us. Because again, and many of you may not realize this, property tax, no one likes to pay it, but it doesn't come to us. It's, look, every penny counts, but in the grand scheme of things, we ride our income taxes. It's 90% of our undesignated income. So jobs matter. And that's, we knew that. We're built out, so we're not gonna attract some huge new manufacturing. There's not really a place to put it. So we're like, all right, well, what do we have? Well, we have a downtown and it can probably perform at a higher level. So that's where we strategically spent our money, partnered, and you know, probably $200 million later. I mean, we had about $10 million in, Kent State had $10 million in, and then everything else has been like all the private investment. So it's a great story. And I hope as you walked in the lobby, we just finally got around to unboxing some of the awards that the city received. And it's there's a lot of them. I had forgotten about a lot of them, but we got a lot of good accolades. So we're celebrating that a little bit as you walk in the building. So the good news is that we had to build a new police station. If you hadn't seen the images, I still had the PowerPoints with the ceiling hanging down, water dripping. The jail was in violation of state requirements for years. So we went to the voters and said, we'll do a temporary 0.25 income tax increase to build a police station. It can only be used for that, basically the structure of the building. And that was going to have like a 30-year payback period. We've outperformed. Thankfully, the downtown had such great new income tax generating capabilities that we were beating that to the punch, so to speak. And we can probably retire the debt. If everything continues relatively on the path it's on now, Rhonda's hopeful that by the end of this year, we will have enough to finish paying off the debt that can be paid now, and the other will put in escrow. But we won't need the income coming in. It'll be in escrow because some of the bonds we can't pay off yet.
Correct.
We still have to wait, but that's okay. It's just a bank. That's a matter she can take care of with escrow and paying it off. So at some point early next year, I mean, maybe sooner, maybe later, we're going to have a conversation with you about, okay, it's time to take 0.25 off the board, off the income tax. Because that was what we said. It was temporary once we have enough. So that's good news. But what we're also going to suggest, and that's what's in here, is that affords you a unique opportunity. because I know many of you on your campaign trail said when they afterwards, after you won, you came in like, oh, you know what I heard a lot? People want more paving of the roads and a couple other things too. But I mean, that was such a common theme, and that led the last council to say, hey, get your staff in here. Tell us what you need to do more roads. So Melanie did that. And we also been hearing for a while now about the police and fire. The calls are up. Staffing's been flat. And actually, in some respects, staffing's down because there's fewer people wanting to get in the field, particularly the police field. So there's always vacancies. All that stress kind of culminates in short staff shortages, a lot of overtime, changing sort of job expectations of the market today. Employees today may not be as interested in overtime the way previous generations were. It's just a reality that we're all dealing with. So we're kind of having to change on the fly. And that all led to the 333. I can tell you departments want, you know, more than that. But we're like, this is what we consider the critical needs, the immediate critical needs. Three police, three dedicated for paving only, and three fire department. And so that was kind of the baseline parameters we were working with. And we kind of reverse engineered our way into this, right? Like, okay, how much money do you need then for that? And that led us to look at the income taxes, and it popped up on the radar screen pretty early, 0.25. If that goes away, would it be a reasonable option to consider asking the voters to basically put a new 0.25 back on? So it goes away, comes back, what everybody pays stays the same. But what it would do is roughly, depending on what the income taxes do, well, let's round it to $2 million a year that would previously were being set aside only for police station. That's all could now, $2 million could now be available for three cops, three firefighters, paving. Depending on, there's variations of that theme, and that's in here, and we can talk about those. That's kind of the middle theme. You could go a little higher, keep residents' income taxes exactly the same. You could generate a little more money that would allow you to consider. There's been a lot of talk about parks funding, the master plan. There's been a lot of talk. Well, I'm looking at Joan. I know she's retiring, but her health department is essentially like Angela's. It's supposed to be mostly self-sustaining. And over the last couple of years, last 5-8 years or so, it's grown, but its revenues haven't grown. So we're putting in more city money. So that's a question for you to consider at some point too. In this package is like, do we want to continue to do that? If so, how do we make sure we can still do that and pay our bills? And candidly, there is a second tier of the fire could really use an additional two. And then Melanie has two laborers that she's been asking for forever. And she can make a compelling case for, I can do certain things with those folks in-house that would allow me to make some savings out of house. Those are all great, but fundamentally, you sort of are going to look at, we've given you three basic options, variations on the 0.25 for you to consider. With our goal as a staff is to say, no increase in city resident taxes. And so we can talk more about those. That's the basic framework. Some of the quick running through, Jack's yawning, and he told me if I yawn, that's your signal, Dave, wrap it up. Sorry. I just want to touch on these points just so that you're all clear. And as I run through these, if you have like, hey, I don't understand that. Look, I already mentioned our staffing needs. Look, almost 72% of our costs are people. We're a service business. So I know people love to say, let's trim, let's cut. Well, that's great if there were areas really where that you can make a substantial, that means cutting people, which is sort of the reverse of what we've been hearing from council. So that's number one. Number two was, good news is, relatively speaking, we're probably as well off as we've ever been. And that means our income tax has outperformed our projections, as I've already mentioned. It's not enough to do all those, the 333 thing that we've talked about, or any of the extra parks, or, you know, I mean, you guys are starting to get your feet wet, right? And Chris is like, can we use money for medical debt relief? Can we use money for housing? Sarah, we've talked to you about challenges over in the Franklin Villages, and how are we going to pay for that to protect our residents? And so I don't think any of you would say there's a shortage of needs, right? I think even the new people are starting to be like, yeah, there's a lot of needs out there. And I know Heidi and Benjamin have talked about getting more in the housing development, potentially, you know, something in the housing. And we hope to queue that up when we get the housing data, right? So that you could be as strategic as possible, because I'm telling you, we ain't got the money to miss the target. And if you doubt that, that's where you flip the page and you start looking at the community profile data. And, you know, we did comparisons, some of which are a little dated, but I don't think they're going to be out of date in terms of relative ranking. We're a high needs community and low resource community. We have more renters, we have more low income, all the categories demographically that are typically affiliated with high service needs. We have a high in all those categories. That's great. That's part of what makes Kent Kent, but it means it's a high demand on our services. And our activity levels match that too. We pretty much outpace our neighbors. And we talked about it, Bridget mentioned, we're a college town. And as you know, College Town has unique challenges, some good, some less good. I think Heidi, you made a reference to, wow, it was busy along Main Street this weekend. And well, that took some attention from the city staff too. And those are the kind of things that happen all the time, right? So we're high activity level. We've got a high needs community. And I don't know, I'm always surprised at how people are surprised at this next stuff. We're the highest poverty in our area. We're the second lowest, just by a hair, of low of the median income. Ravenna beats us out by that. But we are a low resource community. And now I think, in a way, I'd like to say it's a credit to council and the work the staff does. When you look around the community, as you look at the level of services, you look at the investments that are happening, the things, you don't feel like you're in a low income community. And I think that's a credit to, one, we had to be really smart as a team and use our money to optimum effect, right? Like I said, we don't have the luxury of some of our wealthier communities around us that can be like, let's throw $1 million at it and see what happens. We'll be out of money pretty quick in that context. So that's not been our style. That's not been our strategy. And, you know, we will continue to push that to some extent, even on you guys. Forgive us if we do that. If you're like, you may have great ideas, but sometimes you might say, hey, can we maybe not do that? Because this reason or that reason, it's not in the core. It's not in the center of the target, right? Like, it's on the periphery. It's a great social program, but we only have so much money. And those are the kind of things that we weigh all the time. So we're low income. We haven't changed, other than the very specific police station, which again, I can't use for operating monies at all. We haven't changed our income tax since 1984. We're essentially working on that same rate that we had back then. And that's fine. We're proud of that, because our income tax is there has been real growth in the tax base. So it has brought in more money. And it's, and as you've seen in the charts, it's particularly picked up after the downtown. So Rhonda's like, I knew you were going to talk. I didn't know you were going to talk this much. It is a low tax rate by comparison. One of the things that, honestly, I hadn't done the study before. I thought it was interesting, though. When you look at the communities that have the higher tax rate, it's the ones that have more poverty. The poorer communities need a higher tax rate just to keep pace with the richer communities. Interestingly, we're actually in with the richer communities. Our rate is there with what the richer communities are charging. We don't really reflect the poorer communities. Again, we're proud of that. We're not arguing to change that. In no way am I suggesting that. We're proud of that. So there is, at the end, number eight, there is a legitimate imbalance at this point in terms of what we can afford with the current structure and the expectations. So our job, I guess, as a group is to figure out where we can match expectations to affordability. And that's where those, like I say, there's those opportunities to look at kind of a couple different ways. Unless you tell me otherwise, I am guessing, and we certainly don't like to do it, haven't done it in my 20 years, really. We don't want to ask for a tax increase, right? I mean, what new council member comes on board and says, I'm going to do a tax increase? I mean, you can. And that's fine if you do. I'm not suggesting you can't. Now, but theoretically here, what we were suggesting is you have that unique moment in time where we're going to take a 0.25 off, that you could just restore that, ask the voters to vote that in. And basically everyone will continue to pay the same thing they're paying today, but $2 more million would be used, would be available to do those things that we think are critical and we're hearing. So did you want to say anything specific to my preamble?
No, it's, you just have to remember that when you hire people, it's not just a one-time deal. Mm-hmm. You've got to be able to sustain that year after year.
Yeah. Anything else, Ron?
Only if you have questions on the
exercise. Okay, go ahead, Heidi.
Wow, there's a lot to take in. This, I want to just make a comment. Okay, this was excellent, Dave. Can you get it down to a one-page infographic?
No. I mean, obviously you would need to do something like that if it became a public issue. Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's the thing is we can't just vote this in.
Correct.
This is something that we would have to feel really committed to and really put out a campaign.
Yeah.
I think the timing is kind of good because we're going to have a big election coming up in the fall. So, do you think that this is something that we could put together for, say, to put on the ballot in this fall?
I mean, I didn't finish my thought on timing. You want
to? No, timing is of the essence, really, because you have to have it approved by. It has to be back to the county election board by August. So we have a few months, but.
So let me interrupt you there. Let me just be clear on this. This is not a rush job,
right?
Because you could enact this a year from now. You don't have to. There is a synergy that when you're taking 0.25 off, probably it looks like by the end of the year, and it would make the most seamless transition, like for businesses, even like while they're currently using a 2.25, and then in January, let's say we take it off, but we don't ask the voters until next year. Well, then it goes down to 2, and they get used to paying 2, so they would get a tax decrease for a certain amount of time. But then you'd have to, you know, go back and ask if that's your wish sometime next year. So there might be, like, I had that question to her, and she's like, well. You kind of want to at least think about the timing,
right?
In a way, if you thought you could get it done for November, great. That's the most seamless, but it's not a necessity by any means. It can be next year. And then she can give us input like, well, if it's going to be next year, if you do it in the spring, we maybe put it in effect in July or wait till the following calendar year ends. There are logistical pieces both for the business community and people to pay income taxes and the cities.
You'd want to time it properly so that way you're not taking it off completely and then trying to add it back, because that will be a good
one. Right. Plus, we would want to be able to, if it doesn't go through the first time, we would want to be able to make changes or say, okay, we need to, just like they pass levies, you know, educate the public to a larger degree. But
I don't think we should let process interfere with the time that's going to be needed to educate people. I just think she speaks from, oh, dear God, I got to figure this out. You know, that's true. But we can figure it out if it's not in this next ballot. That being said, I would still say, give it a run, see where you think you're at, you know, in your terms of your ability to get the messaging out there, and see where we're at, and you can decide. But just know that there is an initial opportunity, and then there's probably, after that, it's kind of like it's still fine. It's just, it's going to take some additional administrative work, and there's going to be clunkiness. Let's put it that way. It'll be much seamless this way. It'll be a little clunky, but if clunky is what's needed to get the people comfortable, get you comfortable with it, that's fine too.
We definitely want to make sure that you're comfortable and understanding which process and which way you want to follow.
Jeff?
Yeah, if we did the, well, just if it was combined with one of the options of maintaining the police station, transitioning that corridor, just keeping that in place, and we decided to do the non-residential quarter point increase, that's still good. That quarter, even though it's for non-residential, still goes to the ballot, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
That's something we could do, I would think, would be one to after the result of whatever our first attempt is, just so it doesn't look like an increase. I think, that's just a little comment I have on there. And Ravenna is going to they have a ballot for 2.75 now?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah.
In full disclosure, be aware, our voters in Kendra will be, I'm understanding, they're going to see a school board request that's not small.
Right.
And but that's why we were sensitive to, if any of these options that we presented will not change what you pay, which is different from the school is going to be more, Ravenna is going to be more.
Yeah, and I'm hearing more grumblings about this school levy than I've heard any in the past. I think it's just the situation people are in. So we see how that goes in a month.
When is that going to be?
It's on the May ballot.
May ballot.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Benjamin.
Question about, we provide, the police and fire provide services beyond the city limits, correct? To a couple different, like, which areas?
So fire does Brimfield, Franklin Township, Sugar Bush.
Franklin.
On a contract basis, so there's a fee structure in the agreement in that.
And the police beyond city limits?
Just mutual aid. That's a shared, probably end up benefiting more from that.
Dispatch for
That's true.
Okay. We're saying that we have more call volume and that we have a higher need because of the staffing need. And so we're considering going to the Kent voter and asking for keeping what either path, right? And so I just want to make sure that we are equally thinking about an increase to those contract levels, if that is necessary or appropriate for the call volume, because I don't want the Kent voter to subsidize another area, right? So I just wondered if we could hear back on that question, like, have we reviewed those contracts in the current context of what is being asked of council?
So I'm going to venture out on a limb here, and Chief and Rhonda can correct me if I'm mistaken. The way we calculate per the contract,
this is for Franklin Township,
it is based on budget and expenditures.
The budget number.
So if your budget number goes up because you add three people, their proportional share is going to go up as well.
However, okay. They have a cap.
There is a cap.
And it's, I think there's only, so from 1 year to the next, it can only increase by $40. So if our budget increases, that's too bad. We can only go up that $40. However, the next time we have a contract meeting with them to renew, we would have that then discussion.
Okay.
And I can also add, because Chief, we really didn't get the time to add you've done a pretty good analysis of your fee structure. And he's got, now the fees would apply to anybody necessarily, but whether it was ambulance, I forget, you had a whole list. That's another, to your point, it would be being able to tell people, we're asking as much as we can out of the recipients of the service. So the people that need an ambulance ride, if the chief's proposal to raise our rates gets approved, you can look at people and say, we've impacted the people that receive the service too. We're not asking you just to subsidize out of your good. We're doing both. We're doing all of the above. We're checking those boxes.
And that's for our ambulance billing fees, and that we process that through a third party administrator.
Okay.
So do you have a question?
Yeah, can I ask a question about the structure of the tax, income tax increase potential? Are we allowed to say it will not increase below a certain income threshold for the voter? So essentially propose a progressive tax.
Getting legal there. It may be something we have to look at. I don't. I'm not aware
of anything like that. No, okay. Not through for income tax.
I mean, I'd be curious to hear back from that about that.
So that tell me exactly what you mean, if you don't mind.
So if we're proposing a, if we are potentially proposing an unpopular tax increase that would be across the board, it might, and if we're worried about that, there might be more popular if we propose it in a more progressive way.
But you have to keep in mind that right now it's 2.25%. So even if we went to 2.5%, we're proposing to give that resident a 0.25% refund from the city to get them back to 2.25%. So they wouldn't pay any more with the 2.5% as they are currently with the 2.25%.
Yeah, I understand.
So your question would be if we were rate, I mean, not if, how do I say this? If we were raising the amount we were asking people to pay, I totally understand where you're right. Going with your question. We're not. We're asking them to pay what they're paying today.
We're asking non-residents potentially.
Everybody would have to pay the 2.5%. Everybody would, residents included.
I understand.
Would have to pay it to Rita.
I understand.
And then we would give them that 0.25% refund. They'd have to apply for it.
So part of that logic, as we looked at, you know, the largest employer in Kent State, as they are, you know, contracting. I totally understand why. We have plenty of conversations with them why. We've seen their percentage go from around 40 down to 26-27% of our income tax. And that's probably not changing anytime soon. And yet the demand side of the services probably hasn't changed to that degree. I don't think we've seen that. And so the conversation was, is there a way to one, and not just can say anybody that lives outside the city, lives outside but works here, like could be Davy Tree people too, right? Anybody, tying it back to how can we incentivize wanting to live here and reducing the rentals? How do we want people, what could inspire people besides a $10,000 down payment assistance? Is there a way to structurally almost have a built-in incentive, like if you live here, you can file for a 25% credit on your tax bill. Mm-hmm. Plus, it dealt, like I said, with the reality of we don't have the ability to create a brand new huge manufacturing mega site. So yes, we are going to need to look at the businesses are here and make sure we can try to optimize find that right balance between how to pay for what we need to be that city that they want to have here without excessively burdening the people that live here, since we know the people that live here are not deep wealthy people. Yeah. So anyways, there is intentionally some logic in there, whether hopefully it makes some sense. I don't know.
And you meant 0.25%.
0.25%.
Yes. Okay. I knew you caught it too. Yes. I was like, sorry. I want to make sure that we say that
yes, sorry.
Loud so that everybody heard it was 0.25%.
Sorry.
Any other questions?
Oh, yeah. On what you just said, Dave.
Yeah.
What we don't have in this report is other communities that are doing just that. So the non-resident.
There's one.
One.
And it's where I came from.
Okay.
So one city is doing this. Rita won't participate in refunding that to the residents. We would have to do that ourselves in-house. And I did it and I set it up at Macedonia and I intend to do it here if you guys pass it. Mm-hmm. And if the voters pass it.
We have one example.
Yeah.
I'll follow on if I may. So anytime we go to anyone and say, would you like to pay more for that? I like to see some benefit. And I realize that our staffing needs are acute and that those are real things. But at the same time, I hope that we can continue to talk about like what can we communicate to the community about what additional ads. So we're talking fundamentally about baseline. That's what's presented in this reading, which, you know, if I could assign reading to the community, I'd assign this because I feel like it'd be good for everybody to read this. But but if we're asking for an increase, but just really baselining our services, which is what's been presented, I know that there's additions. I know that there's improved street care. I know that there's improved police and fire support. But to the voter, that without reading some of these things, that might be lost if we don't say that we will be adding a few things. You know, we're talking about the facility next to the police station being reused, community center or senior center or otherwise. We've talked about splash pad for a long time. There just need to be some, I feel like there need to be some elements that are like ads that we're saying like, look, we're maintaining the great services that we currently have, but we also are adding some things. Sorry, this is going into comment.
Yeah, so that's really helpful, but it's going beyond the scope of it. It's really talking about marketing. We want to stay focused on this because we got a lot of decisions to make related to this. So any question, Heidi?
Yeah, I just want to, you know, for everybody's benefit, but for my own knowledge, we do still have a 2% tax credit. Is that?
You get 100% credit for what you pay.
Well, 100% credit. So 2.25. I thought you had to, that everybody still had to pay the 0.25 for the police.
So not necessarily every resident would be considered eligible for the refund, so to speak, because if they're paying 2.5% to Ravenna already, Ravenna's getting that money. We're not getting that money. Correct. So they wouldn't be eligible for our refund. They would have, if they worked at a 2% community and paid that extra 0.5% to Kent through Rita, they would then be eligible for that 0.25% through Kent.
Okay, but it's 100% credit.
We are,
right. Yes. Right. And that's, you know, we have learned kind of but in a difficult way that tax credit can be reduced by council by a vote from council.
Correct.
But I think it's more respectful to work with the public to understand the need for more resources and, you know, allow them to have the voice.
For comparison, Heidi, if I could, I did have that in our chart on that one worksheet type thing, just so that you have, if you reduced it to 90%, that generates 350,000.
Mm-hmm.
So to get to roughly 2 million that we propose, you'd have to drop it by, you do the math, right? I mean, 4 or 5 times. So it would be like a 30%.
It'd be low.
It'd be very low.
Yeah. I mean, and not all communities give 100% tax
correct.
Credit.
Correct.
Do we have that data?
I can get that data from Rita.
Yeah, let's get it. Okay. Let's get that because I think that's important for people to know and it's important for me to know.
Any other questions from council? Anyone from the audience? So you don't need us to make a motion right now. This is the first of our many conversations.
Correct. But I would say we've heard you tonight. If you have thoughts, drop us an email. We don't have to wait till the next meeting. We'll do our best to answer questions. As Hope likes to remind us, we can't debate stuff as a council offline, but you can certainly share your personal opinions with our staff and, you know, again, we're not trying to rush this, but the more we hear from you, the more we understand where you're at, we can try to come up with the best combination. Heidi, that's partly to your point. Part of the reason I put that page in there was you might want to do a multi-layered option here. Mm-hmm. You might want to do a 10% reduction in the income tax plus a 0.25 with the refund plus whatever. I mean, there plus the chief's increase in fees or there. Now, personally, I think there's a cleanliness, there's an administrative logic and cleanliness to what we're proposing because there's an opportunity here. If the opportunity wasn't going, I would be having a very different conversation with you. But the fact that we're going to be retiring that 0.25 is a unique moment in time. And so that you can be able to say, if you're able to prove this and we're able to give you, like you said, Benjamin, a better picture of what it's buying.
Yes.
As part of that marketing effort, then it gives you the ability to say, I can do all that for you and not raise your taxes. And no, you're not going to pay a penny more. That was what drove us. We're like, we got to have this conversation now, because in 6 months, this dialogue will be very different. You know, anyways, yep. Thank you for your input.
Are we ready to move on to the next item? Yeah. So the budget appropriation submission.
So I have included budget appropriation number 3. It's for a few items that you received the memos for. If you have any questions.
Any questions or comments from council? Anyone from the audience? Back to council for a motion.
I'll move to approve with emergency.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? That was easy, Rhonda.
Thank you.
Hey. Health and public safety, Mr. Hook.
I mean, you hate to have conversations about hazardous mitigation plans, but the weather last week, and it's still rivers running high, as the Chief Samuels knows. He was down there in Angela, I guess, checking out the river a little bit. But we had those storms coming through, and I thought, well, we've got a plan in place. It may not be approved, but we got the plan. So they're here just to kind of brief you quickly on what the Portage County Mitigation Plan update and how it affects us. And we need your approval at the end of this.
Great. Thanks.
All right. So I'm the new Jamie. No, I'm just kidding. we decided that we'd go ahead and put this together since it was a collaborative report all the way back in the beginning. Some of you that are here can remember that we actually approved the original plan. It was a 2020 plan by Portage County, and we approved that. This council actually approved it in 2021. But just to give you a little refresh of what it is, it's a very large document that covers every municipality, township, and village within Portage County. It is a large document that we work on together to come up with ways to mitigate definitely different emergencies. Everything from natural disasters to flooding to sewer backups to water to fires to all different kinds of things. We have to come in together, we come up with a plan, and then we do it for the countywide as well as for each individual city. If you remember from the old plan, some of the things that we had done there was to be prepared for our natural disasters, learn the FEMA reviews, be able to get those documents ready and going, make sure that we were updating our NIMS and all of those kinds of things, which we did do and we continue to do each day. The new plan came through and they updated some new things, got rid of some of the old things that were no longer relevant. For us in engineering, one of the things that we went ahead and added was the actual sanitary sewer along the river, as we know that's a big and important thing for us and that we will be looking for funding. Part of what comes through this plan is the availability for us should a disaster occur, the ability to be able to collect that FEMA funding. But more importantly, once we are on this and a part of the county, it gives us the ability to then apply for all different kinds of grants and things that require this to be a part of that sign up. So this opens up other opportunities and gives Jim the ability to get that funding that we so desperately need for projects of that nature. So I'm here before you to ask on behalf of all of our projects, but on my project specifically, that we go ahead and approve this and allow us to work with the county to continue to update this plan and keep it relevant and fresh so that every 5 years we're ready should anything happen.
I won't take too much time. So generally speaking, from a police standpoint, what this plan really impacts for our department is what we look at. Obviously, we're going to be a part of any response to natural disasters, but really where it comes into the police purview, and it's in the report, and they talk about different probabilities for different types of incidents and disasters and stuff. But from a police standpoint, the biggest thing that would impact us on this level would be some sort of a terroristic type incident. Or an active threat type incident. So it is covered in the plan. We've been a part of developing that, working with the county EMA, both to train our officers and to train with officers from all areas of the county. So we're all on the same page. We have the same response tactics and strategies to be able to bring that under one umbrella and respond effectively beyond just the scope of our ability as a police department. We can work with others in the county knowing that we're trained similarly and that we're kind of all on the same page and what our response would look like.
from the fire department's perspective, I would give kind of a similar example of what we saw when the mill fire occurred. We saw multiple agencies converge from all different areas of the county, including Summit County, to assist us with a major disaster. That was in terms of a big downtown fire. But if you could imagine a natural disaster where there'd be flooding, neighborhoods underwater, where we would be doing search and rescue, worried about structural collapse, access to people, reunification, just kind of the full gamut of needing logistics and resources involved. What this plan does for us not only affects us during an emergency like that, but it affects us before the emergency, because if we do a good job with the hazmat team, if we do a good job with our fire prevention, we're out doing emergency planning every day with businesses throughout the community, locating things such as what Dave alluded to prior to the meeting today. I was interviewed on camera by Channel 5 News down at the river. Have you ever seen the river like this? Ironically, we have, and we rescued people out of it last year. So the point is, we're constantly assessing danger and potential gaps in our system. That's our job. And we have to identify those. If we do great work, we've identified them in advance and we've mobilized the right resources to be able to deal with them when they happen. Now, some of the updates for us, NIMS, of course, Melanie alluded to, we all know NIMS is essentially the framework and the language we have to all speak, so we know what we're talking about and we know what piece of the puzzle we are in a big incident. Some of the areas we updated for the fire department, we talked about paramedicine. You know, we have a successful paramedicine program right now. One of the things Sarah does is that she networks with the homeless population. You could imagine flooding down by the river where there's many of these encampments throughout the Kent area, somebody's got to be looking out for them, right? So she knows these people by name. She knows where they are at pretty much any time of the day and any day of the week. So we always want to have that program active and engaged with our homeless population. I talked about pre-planning with businesses for emergencies and those gaps in neighborhoods that could just be at risk based on their topography. Other things, storm clearing. You don't think about that, but if the storms get worse, the fire department's running calls, we're clearing debris off the roads along with the service department. That makes roads passable so ambulances can get in, deal with people that are having a critical emergency. We ran 68 calls on the day on March 13th in 24 hours dealing with exactly this right here. So again, one other thing I think is important, and this was an investment since the last update, when we renovated the West Side Fire Station, that fire station's been there since 1949. It did not have an emergency generator. I worked with Melanie and the architects, and we have an emergency generator, which now makes that a 24/7 operation there, which is fantastic because we don't have to go pull the emergency release on the garage doors to get up at 2 a.m. So what you can see is that this plan is about networking. It's about pre-planning. It's about being engaged, not just here in our own sandbox of Kent, Ohio, but with our neighbors in the county level. The county collaborates with the Ohio EMA. And what we have learned as part of this process is that we need to adopt a resolution to be in compliance. If we don't do that, then we're not part of a plan. And if we're not part of a plan, if there is a disaster, funding won't be available to us. A tornado rips through Portage County, hits Kent, Ohio, and they say, but you guys weren't part of this. And now you need hazard mitigation funding. And so again, I don't suspect this is an issue, but I just want to rise it to the top so you're aware of why we're here. Not only to tell you we collaborated on these changes, but to tell you why it's important. Federal funding, state funding, logistics, and resources. So I respectfully ask that you would vote to approve our changes as part of this plan so that we can sign legislation eventually here and update it and be a perfect fit for a piece of the puzzle.
Great. Thank you.
With the emergency, I believe, correct?
Any questions, Melissa?
So as part of this process, did did some of the gaps that we have in funding that we were just spent a lot of time and energy on, did they rise up that we might not be able to respond as, you know, it appropriately because we are a little bit, you know, we're undersized both on our fire and our police. Does that impact it? Does it give more weight to the fact that we need to close this gap in our staffing?
I think from a planning perspective, yes. Okay. We always plan for that. And yet we I don't know if Dave has alluded to the idea of we've kind of like outhit our class or something, you know, with regard to our staffing levels and the call volume that both police and fire and even the workload service has put in after hours. But I think that we always strive in an emergency to adapt and overcome. That's kind of our motto. That's what we have to do. No scenario is perfect. We didn't know at 8:45 on a weekday that the mill fire would happen. And yet this community and our safety forces and our city water, everybody came together to make it happen. That's what this plan is about. You know, there are always going to be gaps. There's going to be days of lower staffing and days of higher staffing. But what matters is that we did the work in advance to identify these gaps and continue to strive to meet them. This gives us a template to work towards. The paramedicine thing, ongoing, as a small example, right? Networking, there's going to be, unfortunately, some new homeless people with a lot of needs that maybe she doesn't know today. We have to network with those people so that when it's freezing cold outside and somebody needs transported to a warming center, we know who they are, where they are, they're people in the community, and we have resources to deal with it. That's just a small example of what this plan stands for.
Mm-hmm. And I think just to further that, like, I would say this plan is not a staffing study per se.
Right.
This plan is a working document. It's something that shows us what we need to do to be as prepared as we can possibly be to respond when that time comes, regardless of what the disaster is. You know, one of the things that's really important with any emergency management planning is it's got to be an all hazards approach. We don't know what that hazard's going to be and when that hazard's going to present itself. We have to know what our resources are in that moment to be able to respond effectively and who we can call upon when we need help. And that's really what this plan does.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate all the work that you did too, and all the ways that you keep our community safe. Thank you.
I've got two kind of disparate questions. First of all, do we already have generators for each city building?
No.
So there's a gap right there that you've identified that may be eligible for funding, maybe, or that we might be able to resource in some other way.
So yeah, I mean, there's what Melanie and all the staff, but largely it ends up, a lot of the advice comes from Melanie on it, is critical operations have generators.
Yeah. Correct. All of our critical infrastructure, the police building comes 100% up, fire comes up, station two now comes up. You don't have a generator here. This building will not come up. We have working generator at 930 Overholt. Both our plants have backups. Actually, the water reclamation plant does not have any. We have dual feed that comes in there that, believe it or not, doesn't always work. So we are investigating those kinds of shortcomings as well. Part of this plan, though, remember, is really for those emergencies. So when it comes through and we reach the threshold as a county of $890,000, it opens the ability for the state to then declare us a disaster and make those FEMA funds available. So that's in large part what this plan really does do for us. It does help us on the other side when there are other grants out there available to be a part of it, but the majority of this will cover those larger things. We talked about unforeseen hazards and mitigation. Who knew that in 2020 we were going to have a pandemic? Nobody knew how to deal with that, right? Thank goodness we had great people in a place to guide us through what we had to do. That's also covered in this plan.
Well, just a side comment, the solar field could serve a purpose of a hazard mitigation in the case of a utility, a long-term utility outage, because it could fire up one of the buildings. That could be, you know, very helpful. The other question I have is, it is good to see specific projects on here, because I do know, like the sewer pipe relocation, that could be definitely a hazard, as we've seen it, which is why we need to move it. And that could be a pinpoint, like, if it's on the plan. If it's not on the plan, then there's no, then certain funds are not available. I'm aware of that as a funding 100%. Specialist. Yeah.
Just real quick, if I could too, I don't want people to be panicked. I know one of the things you mentioned about the plan is the generator issue. You know, when we have, if we have some sort of a major emergency here in the city right now, yes, we know that this building doesn't have a generator. We also know that our resources are, the need for resources is going to extend beyond the decision-making ability of just Melanie, just myself, or just Jamie. We're going to need Dave. We're going to need Rhonda. We're going to need people there who can make funding decisions, because we know that that FEMA money's not coming in that first 24 hours, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things we are fortunate for, though, is we do have enough buildings with spaces that we can all confer together that are going to be up and operating on generators. So on one hand, yes, is there a need for more, and could this plan help us with potential funding at some point to be able to explore that stuff? Yes. Is there an immediate emergent situation that we wouldn't be able to respond to because this particular building is not on a generator? I would say no. Because we do have resources in other areas of the city where we can pull that stuff together.
Gotcha.
Thank you. Any other questions from our audience member? To council?
I would move to approve this plan as written with the emergency clause.
I'll second.
Yeah, I want to say thank you for our participation in this. And also it also has the benefit of helping to generate that mutual aid kind of spirit, because each community is aware of some of the issues and needs of other communities and strengths that you can rely upon. So it kind of forces discussions. So I think it's a really great practice.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
All right.
Streets and sidewalks.
Streets and sidewaks. Jim Bollingworth, Manaway Street, TID grant application.
Good evening, everyone. We're here to request your approval to submit to ODOT and sign a subsequent agreement if we're successful for a $500,000 grant for the Transportation Improvement District. This project, just a little bit of history, started in 2022. It's a joint effort with Kent City School District and Davie Tree Corporation. We've had public meetings and citizens meetings going from May 2023 to August 2025. And the goal is to improve safety for all users, balance vehicular needs and improvements to other modes of transportation, improve vehicular ingress and egress, and improve aesthetics and gateway entrance to the city.
Thank you for that thorough overview and for the accompanying memo. Any questions from council? Not seeing any. Any from the audience? Not seeing any. Any comments? Would anybody like to move?
All right. I'd like to authorize that with emergency.
Any comments? No. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. You're done. Thank you.